Similar Sea, and we review you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back, so stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. So exalted is Allah, the Sovereign, the Truth. There is no deity except Him, Lord of the Noble Throne.
Brothers and sisters, as you have been previously with us, we were talking about the 116th verse of the chapter. In this verse of chapter Mu'minun, the Holy Quran states, فَتَعَالَ اللَّهُ الْمَلِكُ الْحَقُّ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا هُوَ رَبُّ الْعَرْشِ الْكَرِيمِ. Therefore, high exalted is Allah, the King of the Truth. There is no God but He, the Lord of Arsh of Grace. Now, this verse being mentioned after the previous one, which talked about the creation of the universe not being aimless, also talked about the Arsh of the Almighty Allah, referring to the entire world of existence. Now, one point we wanted to clarify, and the fact is that the study of this system, this order in this world, is one of the main reasons for proving the existence of another world. This first creation is testifying itself for another creation after it. So it becomes necessary to explain further that we know that the world of creation is very ordered, it is very vast, glorious, it is really miraculous, and it has so many mysteries that great scientists confess that all of the knowledge of mankind compared to it is like a single page of a great book. Each galaxy of this world comprises millions of stars. The number of galaxies and the distances between them are so astoundingly immense that even when we calculate them using the speed of light, which travels at the speed of 300,000 kilometers per second, they seem terrible.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi,
a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The order and the accuracy that is found in the structure of even the smallest unit of this world is the same order found in the structures of its very greatest units. They are all seemingly using one system. It seems that they have had one creator. And as far as we know, man is the most complete and the most sublime being in this material universe. At the same time, we know that with all his lofty reputation, man is confronted many difficulties and he has had many miseries and will have in his short lifetime. When the man is graduated from his infancy with all its difficulties, all its problems and dangers, he comes up against its youth with all its social and psychological storms. And not yet does he gain a foothold in adolescence when old age knocks at the door of his life with all its concomitant miseries. Now, is it possible to believe that the purpose of this great system, the purpose of this man and this miracle of creation, is just to exist for a short time, passing these three periods of life with all these difficulties, all these challenges, and then passing away into nothingness? If this were really the case, wouldn't creation be in vain? Wouldn't creation be useless? Let me ask you this way. Would any wise being create this great system for such a small aim? If you suppose that mankind tarried in this world for millions of years, and millions of generations came and went one by one, and the material sciences advanced so much that man could avail himself to the best nutrition, garments, and dwellings, would eating and drinking and sleeping and all these things be so valuable that they would be the sole purpose of this system? So, the study of this great world is indicating that this life is an introduction to a greater one. It is an introduction to a vaster world which is eternal. It is only the existence of such a world that makes our lives meaningful and purposeful. And consequently, it is not strange that the materialistic philosophers who do not believe in the resurrection and hereafter count this world as vain and aimless. If we did not believe in such a world, we would conquer with them. This is why we say if death were the end of everything, the creation of world would be in vain and purposeless. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahadali and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program we discuss problems, issues and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are based upon the holy book of the Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend and guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. We will continue the previous session's topic of how to properly solve problems we may face when raising our children. Last we spoke of that, first of all, we must diagnose the problem, we must then have self-control when exercising our punishment, and thirdly, the punishment must be a gradual process. Dear Sayyid, please let us pick up where we left off last time.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه. Now we spoke about the art of problem solving and we said there are a few things need to be taken into consideration when it comes to the art of problem solving. So there are a few things that we did not have the chance to mention them in the previous episodes, so inshallah we'll try to cover them today. When we look at the methods of problem solving, one thing we need to keep in mind is that when it comes to solution and giving medicine to a problem, there are many ways, not just one. For example, sometimes talking to a child might work.
Right.
Sometimes giving him a story to read might do the job, but sometimes it might not do the job, right? So sometimes you yourself give him an advice, sometimes directly, sometimes you give him advice indirectly, sometimes you let someone else do it, right? Sometimes you might present your solution in a form of, I don't know, an activity. Sometimes you give your solution in a form of a play, or not in a form of what have you. Right. So medicine always, like even now when you go to the doctor, sometimes the doctor gives you a tablet, sometimes he gives you, I don't know, a drink, sometimes he gives you an IV.
An exercise.
Yeah, sometimes he gives you an injection. Right. So as you know, in the same way that medicine itself comes in different forms, because each one would have a different strength, a different way of using it, same thing with dealing with kids and problems.
Right.
That each problem requires a different type of medicine, and the medicine itself changes. So the solutions to any problem always changes. So this is something that parents that need to keep in mind.
Right.
Don't think there's only one solution to everything, and don't think that the problem itself, it always requires the same solution. Sometimes it might require more than one method of dealing with it. So keeping your mind open when it comes to trying to solve that problem.
And on that note, dear listeners, we'll be going on a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to solve problems we may face when raising our children. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Okay, so previously we were saying that the solution itself changes, in the same way that medicine changes. Now, also when it comes to the art of problem solving, one of the important backbone of problem solving is that parents should not despair, should not give up. Because a lot of parents, they expect that a problem that arises in their children to be quickly fixed and out of the way.
Right.
It's not going to be that easy. And I keep saying it's exactly the same way with the body itself. Sometimes you get a problem, you get sick, you don't get cured in one day. It takes time before you heal. It takes time before you treat it and you go back
to it.
It's
a process.
Yeah, it's a process that takes time. So if I'm sick and for, you know, over a week I still have a flu and a cold, and I'm like, okay, I give up, that's it. I'm going to throw myself off a cliff.
Lie down and die somewhere.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't want to be sick. It doesn't work. I just have to cope with it. You know, I mean, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah says, "Imshi bidaika ma mashabik."
Right.
Walk with your disease as long as you can.
Right.
That's how life works. So when
you suck it up, life is tough.
That's it. So there's not much you can do. You taking the right process to get yourself cured. But then the main thing requires a bit of patience, perseverance, and you need to, when you put a solution into place, it takes time. So don't despair, because most parents, they give up very quickly. They don't have this long, long lasting
patience. Right.
They give up very quickly. I've seen a lot of parents, they just can't take it. They might even do it for like half an hour or a day, then they break. I'm like, you haven't even started yet.
That's nothing.
You need to give it time. It requires time, especially with children, because children naturally they're arrogant. Naturally, they have they have pride, and they have so many things going on. It's not easy dealing with them, so they require a parent who is constantly patient, who is constantly willing to go the whole nine yards, as we say, who is willing to keep his cool and what have you, just in order to see this through.
Right.
Otherwise, you're not going to be doing much. And at the end, obviously, all of this, at the end, it will pay off, right? You'll get to a stage you say, Alhamdulillah, yes, it was hard. Yes, I had to go through so much. But at the end, I can see my kids are good. They reached a good result. Alhamdulillah, they are mu'mineen. They're good believers. They're doing what Allah wants them to do. And you can feel that bit of comfort in you as you get older, which is what's required anyway. So when it comes to bringing up children, it's not an easy process, especially in the art of problem solving. If you have a problem and you are solving it, or in the process of solving it, you're
you definitely need to be patient and don't despair. Don't give up. You need to keep going and continue. Now, that's one of the most important things that we have to do when it comes to problem solving. Again, when it comes to problem solving, we need to be very aware, first and foremost, that we need to protect ourselves and have countermeasures and have defense mechanism before the problem starts.
And with that, we'll be going on a quick break.
Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam said, "A child's right is to be kind to him when educating him, forgiving him, covering his mistakes, acting moderately towards him, and helping him."
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to problem solve in a proper manner. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Now, before the break, we were saying that we need to take protective measures before the problem happens.
Right.
Sometimes we end up, as parents, causing the problem to begin with without realizing. So for those parents who humiliate their kids, or they curse their kids, or, I don't know, shout and yell at their kids, you know, like something that the
terrorizing their kids.
Yeah. No. So just naturally, for example, when a mother or father wants to call their kids, they yell out. Like they yell at them very loudly.
Yeah, right.
And they call them like in a very strong, harsh manner. And sometimes they might add a word and two words to it.
Right.
Now, the child is in his room and you want him to come and do something for you. And you just go like in this manner. Now, the child gets humiliated. Now, that is a beginning of a problem.
Right.
Or many problems, to say the least. So what happens is sometimes I need to prevent these things from happening so I don't fall in the problem itself. So, for example, if you know there's a disease and there's a vaccine, so take the vaccine so you don't get that disease, right? So
right.
You protect yourself prior. So as parents, with these problems that we have with our kids, you can see that most of the time it could have been prevented, having the fact that we as parents have taken the proper adequate measures to make sure it does not happen.
Right.
In the first
planning
place.
Ahead, basically.
Planning ahead. So, for example, parents who are harsh with their kids, right? Extra harshness. That results in so many problems, right?
Right, yeah.
Or
of course.
Overspoiling the child. That also causes a lot of problems. Or, for example, comparing children to children and to other people.
Right, yes.
That also causes a lot of problems. A child who, for example, feels that he has less love, less emotion, less, of these kind of thing, affection.
Right.
Well, obviously, you can have problems. So, for example, with kids who don't feel safe in their own environment, you're going to have problems. And so on and so forth. If the parents are not present in the house, the parents are not around, when one of the parents is not in a relationship, you're going to have these issues. You're
right.
Going to have many, many problems.
Naturally. Yeah.
Naturally. So all these problems, they can be prevented, and we can take preventive measures if we just make sure that does not happen. Okay? So I don't do these things. I don't overspoil, for example. I don't become over harsh, I don't swear, I don't curse, I don't do these things, and my problems will be a lot less.
Right.
I don't have to deal with much.
But you say that we need to take countermeasures naturally, but what if the parents are not aware that what they are doing is causing a problem? Because you said yourself they are doing it without themselves being aware of the problem.
That's exactly why me and you are here. We're talking
right.
about the ways a parent could be the best educator or best parent.
Right.
When it comes. So we're giving them these tips. If they don't know it, then they have to learn. I think one of the things
that
we spoke about before, if you remember, we said that parents need to learn.
Right, of course.
So obviously there is,
right.
We can't say, well, he doesn't know. I don't know. You need to go learn. Even Allah,
right.
I think, in Day of Judgment, in the hadith says, when we say to Allah, oh Allah, I did not know.
We didn't know.
And Allah says, Ala ta'allamt? Didn't you go learn? Why didn't you go learn? That's not an excuse you can give me. You had the power, you had the chance.
Right. You have plenty of opportunity, but you didn't go learn.
Exactly.
And with that sobering thought, dear Sayyid, we will have to end today's program. Dear Sayyid, I thank you for your time and for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If the dear listeners have any questions or other relevant comments and feedback, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our website, parstoday.com. Alternatively, you can also find us on the various social media accounts we have on YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Aperture.
At the height of the Cold War, the CIA launches a highly classified, top-secret research program into the covert use of biological and chemical agents. In simulated attacks on enemy populations, entire cities throughout America are contaminated with bacteria, exposing millions of Americans to germ warfare. But the real focus of the research is on mastering the art of mind control. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. LSD had become one of the CIA's key interests for its brain warfare program. As the agency theorized, it could be useful in interrogations. Mind control experiments generally centered around behavior modification via electroshock therapy, hypnosis, polygraphs, radiation, and a variety of drugs, toxins, and chemicals. Now, these experiments relied on a range of test subjects, some who freely volunteered, some who volunteered under coercion, and some who had absolutely no idea that they're involved in a sweeping defense research program. And what was the extent of these brainwashing experiments? How did the CIA use unconsenting people as guinea pigs in thousands of different experiments? Join us on Aperture for your answers on CIA covert experiments.
August 16, 1951. Madness spreads through the village of Pont-Saint-Esprit in the Gard region in France. Dozens of villagers have been victim of these bouts of madness. The press describes men terrorized by snakes swirling in their stomachs. A doctor recounts the evening of the 25th of August, where dozens of locals were seized by convulsions, like in a night of the apocalypse. Reports from the victims are terrifying. Saint-Esprit, they call it the cursed bread drama, because all of those who fell ill ate the bread from the Brion bakery. It's the first time in France that a whole village has gone mad. It made headlines in the press, who wondered what could have caused this collective hallucination. In Pont Saint-Esprit, the locals panic, and nobody will touch the bread. The hearses quickly arrive in the village. In total, 7 deaths, 300 people poisoned, and around 50 admitted to psychiatric wards. first dead were buried, the investigators initially thought it was a return of St. Anthony's fire, a disease that killed many thousands in the Middle Ages, caused by a parasitic ergo fungus that attacks cereals. The baker was accused of poisoning, then the miller. Arrested and incarcerated, they were released after several months. They say that their confessions were made under duress, and above all, the evidence proved their innocence. It was then thought to be water poisoning, mercury, fertilizers, or a nearby gas factory. But the evidence disapproved these theories one by one. Since then, in Pont-Saint-Esprit, more far-fetched theories have surfaced. Nothing is clear, and for decades the incident goes unexplained. But against all expectations, 60 years later, a new theory is proposed. Not from France, but from the United States. An American researcher in the Secret Services, Hank Albarelli, is investigating the suspicious death of a biochemist from the CIA, Frank Olson. A specialist in chemical weapons, he carried out experiments on hard drugs like LSD. He was also in France a few months before the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Afterwards, he kept sinking into depression, telling his wife that he'd made a terrible mistake. Hank Albarelli then made the link with the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Could it have been the CIA and the American Army spraying LSD onto the bread?
I have no doubt at all that Pont-Saint-Esprit was a U.S. Army covert experiment. Initially, I had doubts, and I think initially my doubts were motivated by wishful thinking on my part, where I didn't want it to be an experiment. It was hard to fathom the government doing that. Although at the same time, there were a number of research tracks that were being conducted for the book at the same time. So my being naive about what the government and the U.S. Army was capable of doing was the threshold for that was dwindling.
Is it possible that the Americans drugged an entire village in an ally country, causing, no doubt accidentally, the death of 7 people? Improbable. However, to understand what happened in Pont-Saint-Esprit, we need to look back at the end of the Second World War, when the level of atrocities committed by the Nazis was discovered in the camps. Notably, horrific experiments carried out on thousands of prisoners by chemists or doctors. Men lacerated, poisoned, burnt alive, exposed to radiation. The Allies hunted the war criminals from Hitler's regime. In 1946, in Nuremberg, the doctors are put on trial. 22 men and one woman who experimented on human beings, who they transformed into lab rats, stand accused. The trial sets a precedent. 7 of the accused are sentenced to death, 11 given prison sentences, and 5 are acquitted. As a result, the Americans draft the Nuremberg Code, a model which gives strict rules for experimenting on humans, notably the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. The experiment must be designed to avoid all unnecessary suffering, physical and mental harm. With the Nuremberg trial barely over, the winners remain cynical. The American Secret Service begins Operation Paperclip. Nearly 1,500 German scientists, including war criminals, are expatriated to America. They are offered a new life in exchange for their knowledge and cooperation.
It was a very serious game of propaganda that we were playing. It was almost a show trial. We're putting the Nazis on trial, but in fact, behind the curtain, we're doing some very nasty things ourselves to basically incarcerated people, poor people, individuals who at the time were called feeble-minded and locked up in institutions. And if you were in one of those institutions, whether you were indigent or an unwed mother or had some sort of mental incapacity, there's a good chance that you may have been incorporated in some sort of medical study, possibly for the government or not, where you would have been used and abused.
Assisted by the German scientists, the Americans begin pursuing their goal of the ultimate weapon, and everything is allowed in the name of the Cold War. On the one side was the Army, whose priority is to win the nuclear arms race. At the time, to test the effects of radiation on a large scale, they used their own soldiers, who were docile and disciplined. Between 1946 and 1962, between 250,000 and 500,000 men were exposed to radiation on Bikini Atoll or in the Nevada desert. They were exposed with no protection, unaware of the risks involved, and afterwards the radiated particles were cleaned up with brooms.
How about radiation? You think there's much danger from radiation?
Well, radiation is the least of the worries that the men are thinking about.
I think most people thought that radiation was the greatest danger, didn't they? Where did they learn different?
Well, prior to our instructions here, we received a very thorough briefing before we even came this close to contact with it.
On the other side was the CIA, who was above all interested in psychological manipulation. Their goal was to create an infallible truth serum, wipe memories, turn humans into robots, and program them to kill. Conveniently, in 1948, a researcher in the Sandoz laboratories, Albert Hoffman, discovers a molecule that ignites the Secret Service, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. It's derived from the same rye fungus, long held responsible for the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. It was believed that the hallucinogenic properties of this drug were key to psychological manipulation. Fearing that the Russians would get their hands on Sandoz's samples, the Americans bought all of their stock. The discovery of LSD was a godsend for the Army, who on the brink of nuclear weapons were looking for a weapon that could defeat an enemy without firing any weapons. The man who was head of this program longest was James Ketchum, shown here in uniform. He was a psychiatrist who was working for the military. As a patriot, he was prepared to push the boundaries in his research. He tested around 30 drugs, but especially LSD and the dangerous benzylate. He treated 7,000 soldiers, hundreds of whom later sued the Army because of the side effects that they still experience and attribute to these drugs. However, when questioned, James Ketchum sees things differently.
I think they were very patriotic. They've not been given credit. They've been called innocent guinea pigs, which they certainly were not. They knew what they were doing, and we told them as much as we could about it. We had to limit the names of the drugs because some of them were artificially made. And if we were to give out the name, of course, that would also reveal the structure, and that we were afraid the Russians would get that. They were apparently following our work. We thought they were ahead of us, but actually they weren't. And so they were watching what we did to see what they could learn and use. And they developed a similar drug later themselves.
In parallel with the Army, the CIA was also developing its own programs, codenamed Bluebird, Artichoke, and later MKUltra. But to carry out these programs on a large scale, they needed funds. In 1950, the Korean War gave them the ideal pretext. Some American soldiers were captured. During their detention, pilots admitted having dropped chemical weapons onto Korea, which was forbidden. The Americans claimed this was due to psychological manipulation, and the CIA took advantage of this godsend to obtain budgets that allowed them to work on brainwashing.
During the Korean War, the American pilots who were captured started making apparently false confessions of germ warfare. The first question is, was it really false confessions? But then when they were brought back to the United States, the military and the military psychiatrists studied them and decided that there's mind control operations being run against Americans. So for defensive purposes, we had to study this, figure it out. Therefore, we created MKUltra. Before MKUltra was Bluebird and Artichoke. So the whole rationale is it's defensive. It's because of what the communists are doing. Problem is, the Korean War started in June 1950, and Bluebird was signed into operation by the head of the CIA in April 1950.
In the Edgewood camp where James Ketchum worked, soldiers are called upon more and more. They think they're testing gas masks. In reality, the canisters are filled with a toxic chemical.
They were testing a whole assortment of different hallucinogens like LSD and marijuana and things like that. And they explored other drugs, very high levels of atropine, scopolamine, benzolates, very powerful. And a lot of these soldiers ended up incapacitated. It took them a long time to recover. And while they're in recovery, the doctors cannot do any more experiments because it's basically a very small base and testing operation. In other words, they needed a new site.
It's in this context of the Cold War and secret agents that on the 16th of August, 1951, the tragedy at Pont Saint-Esprit unfolded. France was suffering economically, and the Americans distrusted this ally they couldn't control. The village was under the control of socialists at the time. In the eyes of America, they were Reds, the epitome of the Soviet danger. But the mayor, Roger Castillon, doesn't believe in a foreign conspiracy. Yet American experts like Colin Ross are much more down to earth.
Obviously, that compound didn't just come in the rain or just wasn't sitting around naturally. It was obviously organized, controlled, distributed. So whether it was actually LSD or some other compound, well, doesn't make that much difference. Pont Saint-Esprit is actually not just this happened once in the world in a village in France. It's consistent with all the other experiments on the public that have done in the United States and done for a documented fact.
To achieve their goals, would the Americans be prepared to use a whole village as a laboratory? After all, these are civilians, not trained soldiers. However, in September 1950, nearly 1 year before Pont Saint-Esprit, this is exactly what they did, and in their own country. Off the coast of San Francisco, the American Marines were carrying out military maneuvers. A ship approached the coast and bombarded the city with a bacteria causing nucosomia, Serratia marcescens. The military were testing the effects of spraying this through the air. This classified secret defense map shows the scale of the targeted area. At least 11 people were hospitalized, one of whom died of pneumonia. The villagers wonder why a supposedly festive drug that is loved by hippies would have had such terrifying effects at Pont Saint-Esprit. James Ketchum, the military psychiatrist who specialized in LSD, a little reluctantly, admits that the drug is scary for those who take it unknowingly.
Some individuals could have a bad trip if someone gave them LSD and didn't tell them about it. That's very anxiety producing. Or if they were inexperienced and not particularly well balanced themselves, took a fairly large dose of LSD, they could have a bad trip. How would you feel if you had a cup of coffee and started to see things going like this or like this, or brilliant colors appear on the ceiling, or suddenly you felt you're out of your body and looking down on yourself? These are all things that can happen with LSD.
But can these effects have a delayed onset? In Pont Saint-Esprit, the older generation remember the night of the apocalypse, where dozens of men went mad and were sectioned in a psychiatric unit because of terrifying visions. This night took place more than 2 weeks after the cursed bread was consumed. But again, James Ketchum admits that it's possible.
Some individuals had flashbacks later in which they would go into a situation that where they had been when they were taking LSD and have a flood of the same emotions and some of them anxiety producing.
In 1951, French investigators also consider LSD and call upon Albert Hoffman, inventor of the drug. On the spot, he tells the investigators that he has no doubt that the hallucinations were due to LSD. But after returning to Switzerland, he backtracks, claiming he was mistaken. The French want explanations, but public health documents from 1951 show that the expert became suddenly unreachable. We are sorry that the eminent professor has not been able to get back in touch with us.
I would think if the Sandoz scientists are saying it doesn't seem to be LSD, they're just trying to cover up the fact that it's 100% for sure that LSD must have come from Sandoz, because they were the only suppliers. It's nothing more than a cover-up.
After months of inquiry, the French investigators were so disoriented by the number of fruitless leads that the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit falls victim to its own mystery. During this time, the experiments continued in the United States, and they reached a level never seen before in any country, including the Soviet bloc.
This is Foresight. Program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Today's tip: what are the secrets of the salik when it comes to a submissive heart, when we want to enhance our ubudiyah, our worship of Allah?
Allahu Rabbi.
Now, dear listeners, when we're talking about a submissive heart, which deals with our spiritual wayfaring, of course, which is all done in order to increase and enhance our ubudiyah, well, generally speaking, the salik, the spiritual wayfarer, on the way to the hereafter, and most especially if with the mi'raj, the ascension step of the salah, for we have said that the salat, the namaz, the daily prayers, is the mi'raj of the mu'min. If the salik wants to continue on this path to the hereafter, especially if they want to do so via the salah, the daily prayers, they will have to make their heart submissive, a submissive heart, a humble heart. And this heart becomes submissive via the light of knowledge, the light of ilm, as it is known in Arabic. And the heart becomes submissive, dear friends, via the light of iman, the light of faith. So if we are to increase our ubudiyya, then we must strengthen as much as we can this divine gift and this beneficent gleam of submissiveness in our hearts. For Islam also means to submit. And submit to who? Submit to the Almighty Allah. Now, in order for us to truly increase our ubudiyya and strengthen our worship of Allah and our obedience to Allah, we have to try to keep this state of having a submissive heart during the whole length of our salah, the whole length of our prayers. Now, this state of consolidation and stability and submissiveness and tranquility, it could be a bit difficult at the beginning, especially for people like me, but eventually it becomes quite possible if we practice this state of submissiveness, this state of humbleness and humility, and of course by exercising these aspects of the heart. If we try, and we try continuously, we will, by the grace of Allah, reach our goal of enhancing and strengthening our ubudiyya.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com. Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from Munajat al-Muftariqin, meaning the whispered prayer of the utterly poor. Stay tuned.
نهاري دونكم ليل وليلي كله
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, have mercy upon your lowly slave of silent tongue and few good works. Bestow your favors upon him through your plentiful graciousness. Shelter him under your plenteous shade. O generous, O beautiful, O most merciful of the merciful.
Welcome back to your listeners in continuation to what we were saying, which was this idea that we need to have a submissive heart if we want to increase and enhance our ubudiyya, our obedience to Allah, and our worship of Allah. The spiritual wayfarer must have a submissive heart, a tranquil heart, a heart which is submissive to the glory and the majesty and the grandeur and the power and the might of Allah. And we said that this submissive heart only comes about via the light of ilm and iman, the the light of knowledge and the light of faith. Now, when trying to acquire these various perfections and these provisions for the hereafter, of course, this necessitates that we are serious and that we take these things seriously and that we try our best to fulfill them and practice them as much as we can. And now, of course, the greater a action or the greater a demand is, the more that demand deserves to be taken seriously. So, of course, as we have said, the akhirah, the hereafter, is the greatest of accomplishments. If we succeed in the hereafter, then we don't need anything else. But if we lose in the hereafter, then we have lost everything. So if we are to acquire the hereafter, if we are to be victorious in the hereafter, and we have realized how serious this goal is, then we must pursue it with the same amount of seriousness. And so, the more serious we become in our ubudiyah, in our worship of Allah and our obedience to Allah, the stronger this obedience to Allah becomes. For certainly, dear friends, with a state of weakness and laziness and carelessness, one can never ascend to the divine proximity of Allah, and one can never be in a place which will be a neighbor to the Lord of Might, Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
رجائي بالرضا والخير أنير طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Yusuf.
الله سبحانه وتعالى said إن السمع والبصر والفؤاد كل أولئك كان عنه مسؤولا.
The sound itself, the sight itself, and the heart itself, all of them man has been made responsible for. Allah begins with hearing because hearing is the most difficult to guard. I came into New York City, and I'll tell you something. Going from Mecca to Jeddah was like going from paradise to the gates of paradise. Going from Jeddah to Morocco was like going to a place where I could see paradise off in the distance, but I definitely wasn't in it. And then getting to New York was like a descent into the bowels of hell. And there's no exaggeration about that. Because suddenly, everybody around me was using foul language. It's unbelievable. The only time they don't use foul language is if they're serving you something.